It's the 10th episode of the Rugby League European Federation podcast as we continue to meet with those who contributed to the development of rugby league over the last 20 years or so. So today, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Ben Uro, who was involved in the European Federation. Ben, how are you?
Hey, Graham, I'm fine, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Whereabouts in the world do you join us from, Ben?
Well, as you know, I'm French, but at the moment, and for the past 8 years, I'm in Moscow, Russia.
Oh, fantastic. And you're there with your family, I believe, yes?
Yes, I'm here with my family, my lovely family, wife and children. Everything's fine there.
Yeah. So Ben, you were involved with Kevin Rudd. You did some translation work. You did some coordination work. Very similar role to Julia Bennison, who we talked to a few episodes ago. So before we get into that, Ben, just tell me about your first memory of rugby league.
My first memory of rugby league, as you know, I'm French and I grew up in France. And as most of you must know, rugby league has got a bit of a history, a controversial history in France, as you probably know. And I grew up in a non-rugby playing region. And I always heard about these. It was not even called rugby. It was not allowed to be called rugby. It was a jeu à 13, which means 13-a-side game. And of course, at the time, you couldn't Google it. It was not on TV. So I was really intrigued by these jeux à 13, these 13-a-side game. Yeah. And eventually, I moved to Montpellier for my studies, which is near a rugby league playing region. And I actually got recruited in the nightclub to play rugby league.
Okay. Tell us more.
Yeah, I just arrived in Montpellier. I was a student. I was very young, a bit, unaware of things. And I met those guys. I know they were students. It was a student night. And, you want to play rugby league? We play rugby league in my village. Come on Saturday. Let's meet in Béziers train station at 12 o'clock. So, Béziers train station is, it's about 1 hour on the train from Montpellier. At the time, there was no mobile phone, nothing. So I just got on the train, not even knowing if those guys would turn up, or they eventually turned up 1 hour late. Then they took me in their car. We had to go to drive another hour to some village near Carcassonne. For those who know of the French rugby league playing areas. And, I had no idea what I was doing there. And I was on the bench, so hopefully I thought I wouldn't be playing, just enjoying the game. But after 5 minutes, someone got injured, and I got to get on the pitch, And actually, they explained me the rules, very simple. You see a guy with a ball, he mustn't go through. When you got the ball, run as far as you can towards the try line, but don't drop the ball. The game is so simple. Basically, it's a, you see someone with a ball, he mustn't go through, just tackle him. And when you get the ball, run as much as you can and just don't drop it. That's it. And just, the game was pretty simple. Even I had no clue about the game. On the first game, I played most of the game. Okay, we lost, but we had a good time. So that.
Okay. And then did you start to play regularly for the team?
Yes, yeah, so I started to play for that village team, and then I moved on. I played for Montpellier, and I understood that I was pretty good at it. I mean, I was not obviously not Super League material, but I would say I'd call a good utility player. And I ended up playing a semi-professional for Montpellier. We won 2 French championships, not the first division, but the divisions below. Yes, and I really enjoyed the game. So I played at a decent level for different teams. I also played for, I ended up playing for Lesignan. Lesignan? We won, I played with them. We won the York Nines, I think, in 2003. Okay. And I had some international caps to help the European Federation.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So these places like Carcassonne and Lesignan are very much rugby league strongholds and communities. The rugby league club is right at the heart of them, aren't they?
Yes, Lesignan, Limoux, Carcassonne, then you've got the Perpignan area. That's the heart of rugby league in France, indeed.
Okay. And just on a personal level, was there a gentleman called Andrew Borthwick who maybe played at Montpellier?
Yes, I remember Andrew Borthwick, and one of your fellow Scotsmen. Yes, he played for Montpellier. We played together. We won the National Division 3 championship together.
Yeah.
Yes, Andy, I remember him very well. He was a great player and a great guy also. Yeah.
I remember him playing at Rugby Union at West of Scotland, but also playing for Scottish Students, better known as Soupy, I think, rather than Andrew Borthwick, to give him the title that people would recognise him by rather than his proper name.
I think he lives in Newcastle now, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Oh, Nottingham or Newcastle? I don't know.
I think it's Newcastle, yeah. Well, listen, so you've got a good... you've not grown up with the game, but then you've discovered it. And I can understand all of that, and you've got yourself into a semi-professional setup. So tell us how you made the move from playing into some of the administration, Ben, and how did you get involved in the European Federation?
Well, I started to grow a real passion for the game. You know, I was passionate even within my families, and was talking about the game all the time, you know, especially in France, you know, with the political stance between rugby union and rugby league. I'm not anti-union, but you know, I thought league should get a fairer treatment, of course. So I was a bit of an advocate, and then I decided to move to the north of England. So I ended up in Sheffield, which is maybe not the rugby league heartland, but not far. I play for the Hillsborough Oaks as well. Nice team. Really enjoyed my time there, and I was really passionate about the game, and I was an avid reader of Rugby League Express. I was reading everything, articles, and then I saw an article, like Julia, Rugby League, I knew there was a Rugby League European Federation. I was dreaming of being able to help, and I saw this article, you know, looking for a French speaker who could help, you know, with the Rugby League European Federation. So I immediately applied. I think at the time I was probably the only Frenchman living north of Nottingham in England. So quickly I got a phone call from Kevin Rudd. And he said, oh, I'm passing by in Sheffield. So we decided to meet in a cafe. And actually, funnily enough, on that day, Kevin Rudd was also with Danny Kazanjian. They were together.
Yep.
So we met the three of us in the cafe and started discussing about opportunities. And, you know, Kevin was very interested in my ability to speak French, obviously, my love for the game. And he asked me if I could help with a bit of translation at the beginning for articles and helping with a website. And quickly asked me if I could come down to some meetings, you know, where Richard Lewis was meeting with Nicolas Lara, which was French president at the time. So meeting at the summit. And I remember having the difficult task to translate. And so it was a bit daunting task. I remember it was a Dragons Catalans official launch. So all the press was there, all the media were there, all the British media was there, the BBC, Sky Sport, everyone was there. It was in Perpignan. And I was between Richard Lewis and Nicolas Lara, and I had to translate everything.
Just out of real interest, for the translation work, obviously you translate words, but how do you translate tone? Do you factor that into your translation? How does that work? Give us a bit of an insight, Ben.
Yeah, it is very difficult because you try to convey the message as much as you can, but sometimes, you know, you don't want to upset, so you feel like you want to, you know, if there's something a bit upsetting, you want to tone it down.
Right.
But you won't also want to translate, not to mention that there's a lot of stakes. There are other people around that try to push their agenda, obviously. Because if it was just me, I remember there were people around who spoke a little bit of French, a little bit of English, trying to push, to make their own interpretation. So it's very difficult to actually, in a lot of pressure, political pressure, to keep the message as neutral as possible. Try to convey it. You know.
Yeah. And do you have to sort of put a time limit to Richard or Nicholas, saying, "Listen, you can only give me 30 seconds at a time," because obviously you're listening, and but at the same time, you've got to remember when you start to translate it, or was those rules not in place?
No, it's true. Actually, with with Nicholas and Lewis, Richard Lewis. It was pretty, because they were quite concise and they were quite articulate. I remember before I had a couple of years before had to make a translation between some members of the French Federations and the New Zealand rugby team who were on tour, and I was translating as well. And I remember the time the French were not concise at all, and it was a real pain for me to translate because they were just rambling on and on. With Richard Lewis, who are and Nicolas Lara, who are seasoned professionals in their job. You know, Nicolas Lara is a lawyer. Richard Lewis, you know, is a professional chief executive, and they knew how to make a concise message. So it was they make my job a bit easier.
Yeah. Well, I work for Richard Lewis, and I could clearly understand that, and I did meet Nicolas Larat as well. So I think you're probably right there. They were both professional people. Tell us a little bit, because that England-France relationship, they are the two major nations in the Northern Hemisphere, albeit probably England, the bigger brother, as it were. What was the sort of dynamic you found between England and France, and how did you help to try and broker that in a sort of diplomatic sense?
Yes, I mean, you understand, like, rugby league in France is always the English, you know, the English, they hate us, you know, this the traditional French outlook on the English, this, 100 years war or whatever. I felt a lot of positive attitude, a big push from the RFL, especially Richard Lewis. You know, he was really pushing forward to give France, the better seat, and to give France a better influence. You know, he really wanted to be a, from what I gather, he wanted to be a, a real duo, unfortunately from the French side, there were a lot of people really keen on it, but maybe for financial difficulties, or I don't know, it was not always, the words were there, but the acts were not always there, which was a bit disappointing, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
No? Yes. So the French were keen on taking the back seat, but when it was time to pay for the petrol or the toll, because we have tolls in France, they would keep their hand in their pocket, which was a shame, because it was a great opportunity for the French. I know the French, it's difficult to blame them as well, because it was at a time where the game was a bit of a crisis in France in itself. The game is facing a lot of difficulties in France, so the money is scarce.
Yeah.
But we, to be fair, the Richard Lewis, the RFL, gave us a hope in hand. I think it was a genuine effort for getting the French on board to the right level. And maybe the French failed to respond positively to that. Also, although I knew a lot of great people from the French Federation were keen on it, but
Do you think maybe what is still got in that way, the sort of general attitude of the English and the French, the French, not wanting to be told how to do things by England.
I think it was beyond that. I think the French lacked vision, maybe, or lacked resources in face in the future.
Okay. Because, of course, both nations would have, obviously you alluded to the past history of rugby league in France and round about the Vichy government and things that happened around about the Second World War. But of course, England as well, the social and cultural history, it's only in 2004, it's less than, 10 years from when, you could still be banned from being playing rugby union because you played rugby league. So there was not a little bit of almost band of brothers between the England and the French, where they'd both been, discrimination against, or was that not something that was brought them together enough?
To be fair, I think, people, even at the time, now it's obvious, but at the time, rugby, the European Federation was not an obvious thing in England. I remember there were a lot of the critical voice against the ILEF at the time. I was reading, as I said, Rugby League Express, many columns from some kind of famous rugby league figures saying it was a waste of time at the time. You know? And I think Richard Lewis, and we have to give him credit to that. He really pushed it, you know, he really understood that the future of the game, you would have to move beyond the M62 corridor and Perpignan, you know. And thanks to Richard Lewis, I think the RADF is where it's at today. That's my opinion. So was there a solidarity between France and England? I don't know.
So let's obviously the translation is a part of it, but of course you really got involved in lots of different things, and you started to travel out to, I think, junior internationals to start with, and got involved in Euro Shield. So give us some of the insights of the places you went to help people and to oversee matches, Ben.
Yes, so Kevin got quickly overbooked with with everything. So thankfully, it gave me a lot of chances. So I was a tournament director and referee for the Euro Nations, Emerging Nations. So I remember it was one of the great times, 2006. It was a trice tournament between Estonia, Germany, and Austria. A very interesting time. So I went to Bad Eichenau, which is in south of Germany, probably the most scenic rugby league ground I've ever seen in my life, in the mountains. We had a fantastic game against Austria. Then I went to Estonia, Germany, which was amazing. Anthony Siebold, you know, Brisbane Broncos head coach now.
So he was playing in that game, because Simon Cooper talked about that game.
Yes.
You were there as well.
Yeah, I was the referee and the tournament director. He was there, but he's there. He helped a lot. He played, but he was not there to show off. You know, he was playing, I would say, in an educative manner. You know, he really led the game. The way he played, he wanted the game to develop. You know, do you understand?
Yes.
He wanted to give opportunity for his team to play, and even for the opposition to look good. You know, I don't know how can I explain that. If you understand the caliber of the guy, he really understood how to make rugby league look pretty. You know, he was there to, not for him, he was there to make the game develop. If that makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
He was really helpful. You know, he was organizing his team, he was coaching his team, he was organizing the game at the same time. You know, because when you play in a development context, you know, there's no point crushing the opposition, whatever. And it was a fantastic game. It was a competitive game. The Kainos brothers played. Right. Estonia had a great team. You know, a lot of good lads from Estonia. It was an amazing time. You know,
We played. Okay. So where else were you involved? I think Malta, was that somewhere else you went to?
Yeah, let me finish. The last game, we went to Austria, and we were looking for a pitch. And out of nowhere, there was a guy looking like Professor Calculus, you know, in Tintin, Professor Calculus.
Yes.
There was a guy who called us. He said, I've got a rugby pitch in the middle of the mountains as well, in the south of Austria, near the Italian border. He had a rugby pitch with like with an electronic display board, you know, with an electronic scoreboard that even rugby league team would cry for it. In the middle of nowhere. You understand?
Yes.
And I don't know what this rugby pitch was doing. Like, it was a village, maybe 100 people in the village, you know? And there was a rugby pitch, brand new, nice, with a scoreboard, electronic. I mean, he spent about 2 hours to fix the electronic scoreboard. Well, we played there, Austria, Estonia. The Estonians came by car from Estonia, you understand? I think half of the car broke down on the way. Another amazing moment. Anyway, Austria won that game.
There you go, the places that rugby league reaches.
Malta was my first international trip. So it was also a very, eye-opening experience. It was the England Lionhearts. There was the Australian ambassador was involved as well. The Maltese came from Australia. They tried to involve as many Maltese players as they could. Yeah, it was a big tour. You know, the Austrians put a lot of spins around it, a lot of tension. The referee was Ashley Klein, who a week before refereed the Rugby League Grand Final.
Right, yep. And now our NRL referee for about the last 10 years.
So he came down. I tried to talk to him, explaining that it was a development game. He would have none of it. You know, I was trying to say to be easy on the red card and everything, because the tension built up between the English and the Australians, and obviously, the game was a bit rough.
Okay.
So Mr. Klein had to give out the red card, and I said, on a couple of occasions, which was a bit of a shameful development game, but that where it was. But then he ended up in all good spirits, so that what matters.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, no. What I remember from all my missions, it's you really have to deal with egos, frustrations, and a lot of tiny petty things. That's unfortunately, that's, you know, what you got to deal with. In your ideas, in your mind, you have the future of the game. You think about rugby league. Maybe you're a bit naive. Maybe you're a bit you're wishing for the best, and you need to deal with people.
Sure. And in Kevin would talk to me about how your European mainland viewpoint or perspective would help him from the Anglo-Saxon viewpoints of things. So were you conscious of that, being able to add, along with Julie as well, to have a combination of perspectives on matters? Because you're dealing with a whole lot of different cultures, aren't you, across the whole of Europe?
Yes, that's true. I mean, that's what I tried to explain to Kevin, because he took a light, because I'm French, so I've got a continental point of view, and the Anglo-Saxon point of view is completely different. You know, just having coaches, going to schools, having a more liberal approach of coaching and everything, that's a given in England. And I work as a coach in England, and it's great. But you understand, in continental Europe, it might be more territorial. You know, most coaches that go to schools are civil servants sometimes, or they can see the way they're coaching as their own patch, you know, that's don't touch it, you know. And they're supported by the state, or they can get they get paid whatever they do. So this mentality, this liberal mentality, it's not part of the European mainland, you know. Like when we went, it was not with Kevin, I went with Gary Tasker. You remember Gary Tasker?
Yeah, do indeed, yes.
Yes, I went with Gary Tasker in France in a fact-finding missions, and Gary Tasker wanted to understand what was happening in France, how they would develop the game. And he couldn't understand how difficult it was for French coaches to go into schools. Just that.
Right. Okay.
So yes, you have a very different, and I can see here in Russia, the mentality again is very different. You know, coaches are very protective of their pupils or the people they coach. So there's a lot of obstacles that maybe don't exist in an Anglo-Saxon world, I would say. Yeah. Not that the Anglo-Saxon world is the best for everything, but it's got some positive things.
But for a federation that was growing and reaching new countries, you know, regularly, to have that different perspective from, you know, the RFL, the Rugby England, was very, through Richard Lewis, very benevolent to try and get things started. But of course, it had to learn different cultures. So it's crucial for you to be able to feed that back in and add that perspective. But presumably along the way, you were learning about new cultures, to be going new places as well.
Indeed. But, you know, you just realize the copy and paste doesn't work in those conditions. But at the same time, you know, people always have excuses. And, you know, you cannot listen to all the excuses all the time. You know, you got to get things, you got to push things, otherwise nothing will happen. Yeah. You know, as I remember, a lot of people were Hey, it's normal. It's human nature. But, you know, they're always saying, oh, rugby union, give money like this. Rugby union, give money like that. And, you know, the rugby league culture, you know, is do it yourself. A bit more, you know, because rugby league, it's fair to say that we've never been a super rich sport. We do things, you know, with heart. We do things with passion. We do things, you know, benevolently, you know, we do things, you know, if we're in rugby league, we're not after the money, basically. So we'd be doing something else. And, you know, a lot of people in the culture, they have, you know, they're waiting for subsidies to come down. If I can express things like this, if you see what I'm saying, or no?
Yep. So tell us, Ben, just tell us some of the characters, just in general, that you remember from your time, and any stories you've got about, you know, you know, telling a great story there about uncovering this pitch, you know, with the electronic scoreboard. So have you got a few more you can share with us?
Well, I don't know. I've just met a lot of characters in rugby league. I mean, rugby league, again, it's about the people at the end of the day. You know, maybe I can be a bit critical sometimes, but the reality is, you know, most of the people I worked with were just fantastic people. Never happened to me that I was invited in so many places. People invited me to their houses in every country, even in England, you know, to stay overnight, meet their parents, meet their family. You know, doors open, people are genuine. What can I say? You know, characters. I remember the German trio, Simon Cooper, who passed away, who left us, sadly, Leo Ben Gruber from Bad Heichenal, and Uwe Janssen. They were just amazing. You know, I think the guys really pulled the right team together. You know, thanks to them, Anthony Siebold supported them. There were the other guys, I think they were mentioned, Danny Stocks from Hemel, Mick Dwyer, the physio as well from Wales. So they managed to bring a nice team around them. There's someone who's not, I think he's still working for you, someone who hasn't been mentioned, who works in the shadows, if I can say. Have you heard of Phil Kaplan?
Yeah, Phil's still with us. Yeah, media manager. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, is the man behind all the stories. You know, he gives shape to the stories. You know, we bring him reports, photos, notes, and he's a guy. You know, I don't know if Rugby League European Federation would be there without him, because he is a guy who put all the stories in shape for the public. Serbia's got a lot of interesting characters. Jovan still works for you, right?
Indeed, Jovan does, yeah.
Blagoj, I think, is he on the board? Was he on the board, Blagoj Stolkovic?
Blagoj was, yeah. He came off a couple of years ago.
Yeah, Blagoj is also an interesting character. I think he was a rugby union stars in the 60s in Yugoslavia. We also have characters who are there for the wrong reasons, but that's part of the game. you understand, being in a European Federation, you know, we are very keen on helping people, but some people, you know, we don't suspect all the time that some people might want something else. You know, we're here for the game. And of course, when we started, we couldn't start suspecting everybody to be there for the wrong reasons. You know, that was not the approach.
Yeah. So, Georgia would be a case of that, wouldn't it, Ben? Because it's one of those key skills. Talk to Kevin about, I think I've talked to Julie about, is when somebody wants to move the game forward, and then you know, you're obviously keen to support, as you say, but you've got to work out what the motives are. And Georgia was an interesting one, the first person who came forward, a gentleman called Petta, wasn't it?
Pata. Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, we cannot name people and just assume, you know, that's it's a bit, you know, some people are there, you know, I think, how can I put this, you know, at the time, maybe it's not so true today, but at the time, a lot of people wanted to have a foot in the EU for whatever reason. So a lot of extra EU countries saw the European Federation as a, as an interesting way to set a foot in the EU, I think. But, you know, we can just assume. Difficult, but to be fair, I mean, Kevin was smart enough and he understood, he clearly saw, you know, he clearly could select the people that were worthy of spending time, you know?
Yeah, sure.
Kevin is a good-willed person and, you know, he would always give the benefit of the doubt, but he's smart enough to understand when there are enough elements that he would say, well, maybe this guy is not what we need. You understand?
Yeah.
At the same time, we cannot, you know, there's no evidence. We cannot accuse people. We just think, you know, there's just things, there's just elements that make us think that it doesn't smell right. So Georgia is a very interesting case. And, you know, because Georgia put a great show. I was the last match commissioner for the last Georgian game in front of 14,000 people. It was crazy. It was Georgian National Day, Georgia Netherlands. Amazing, amazing match. And just after that, they pulled the plug. So we never heard from them.
Yeah. And then Ian Thompson was, of course, been a guest on this, and he talks about that day as well as, you know, an amazing day in Georgia, as you say, in front of all those fans. That must have been quite an occasion.
Yes, almost a fan, and we were as well. Me, myself, Vinnie Webb, and the referee were they invited. You know, it was it was Georgia Independence Day, and then we were invited to the main stage on the main square in front of maybe 500,000 people, whatever, I don't remember. And we were pushed forward, and we were introduced to the crowd for some reason. It was pretty crazy. We didn't believe it. You know, and then we went taken to a party. There was probably 200 people. They were all rugby union people. And it was a massive Georgian party with massive tables full of food. The more you were eating, the more food they brought, you know, seafood, meat. It was just wine. It was just too much. They put us in one of the best hotels. I think they were doing too much. I don't know what they were. I mean, that's Georgian hospitality. We had a great time. But at the same time, I could feel something wasn't right. I don't know why. Well, you know, it's difficult to know. Actually, I'm still friends on Facebook with some of those people from the time. I should ask him, but we don't know what happened.
So is there anything else, just looking back, that stands out for you as a favorite memory?
Well, as a favorite memory, that's difficult to say because, I mean, you know, when I think back of all my time in the European Federation, there are so many amazing memories. You know, like I was bombarded tour manager for the Scotland students in Holland and Germany at the time in 2005, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty an amazing time with John Wiseman.
Yep.
As you may know.
Yeah.
I refereed, I think, the first game in Spain, which was in Girona with the Lidakis.
All right.
Okay. Of course, that Georgia-Holland match with 14,000 people, and that's something you cannot forget. My first tour to Malta. Also, I was a tournament director for Euro B between Serbia, Czech Republic, and Germany, which was a great tournament. Winning the York Nines was good. I don't know. I just can't name dropping. Also, setting up the Euro Celt. You remember the Euro Celt?
No, remind us what that was.
It was an invitational site because the Celt, it's not only the Celtic nation. The Celt were the first inhabitants of Europe. So it was the kind of a barbarian European Federation side. And the first time we gathered the Euro Celt was for a junior tournament in Serbia. So we gathered some Welsh guys, Irish guys, Czech guys, and Serbian guys actually joined us as well. The team was coached by Ray Caldwell from North Wales. Do you know him?
I remember the name, yes.
Yes, actually, I got the first training session, you know, we just arrived, we got these people from all over Europe, and Ray says, okay, those who don't speak English, raise your hand. If they don't speak English, anyone, oh, that's true. But actually, the funny thing is actually some North Welsh guy raised their hands. So anyway, we had a great team and we finished third of the tournament behind France and England. France and England had people, they had people who became Super League players. Mm-hmm. So there are so many memories, you know. But if I have to choose one, yes, I would probably choose the Georgia-Holland game in Tbilisi.
Quite understandable, yes.
Okay.
And just on your own personal story, Ben, when you moved on to the European Federation, you moved in to be the general manager of London Scholars for a couple of years under the guidance of Hector McNeil. How was that as an experience, London Scholars?
Indeed, yes, because as a European Federation, then I moved on to help with the organization of the MX9s, the LAT MX9s in 2007, when we were back at Wembley, we had a great tournament. And then they asked me if I could be the general manager of the... Well, yeah, I have to say, you know, you have a completely different look on rugby league. It was a very difficult time. London is a very difficult place for rugby league to survive because you're in competition with so many sports. And the board was very demanding. Of course, I know that Hector McNeil can be a controversial figure in rugby league, but I'd like to thank him for the opportunity he gave me because although it was very, I worked there for nearly 2 years and probably the two hardest years of my professional life. But I have to say, you learn a lot. You learn a lot about the game, about the needs of finance, the need of development, because the scholars were encompassing everything, you know, the professional side, the development side of things, the financial side of things. So yeah, it made me an all wonder for the game. So it made me very confident to do anything after that.
Oh, okay. And then you moved on to, what was your next stop? Was that then into Moscow at that time or?
No, actually, thanks to the scholars, I realized I was quite good at fundraising. So I applied for different charities.
Okay.
Become a fundraiser and I had a lot of success actually in fundraising. Now, after you fundraise for the scholars, you can fundraise for anything.
Okay. Right.
And I moved to Moscow in 2012.
Okay. And you've obviously, it sounds like you've kept in touch with some of the friendships you developed, and you've obviously kept your eye on the game, even in Russia.
Yeah, actually, my first port of call was rugby league when I moved to Russia, but rugby league was such in a difficult state in 2012 when I get there. So I left it by the side, but I kept in touch with Jovan and some expats now that are in Russia involved in the game. So hopefully I can, you know, we've been talking. I know there was a COVID situation, but hopefully I will be involved with the game pretty soon.
Good. Well, that's great to hear because, you know, the experiences you've had, Ben, are invaluable. You know, even right back to jumping on a train on the basis you could be playing a game, you know, and that sense of adventure and putting yourself out there and all the stories you've told about the new places like Malta, you were there, and the rugby field in Austria, that pioneering spirit about it. So it's great to hear that you're doing well in Moscow and you know, you may look to get yourself back involved. Fantastic.
Yeah, that would be great. You know, Russia is obviously the big ship to turn. A lot of things are happening there. I mean, if Russia could work, that would be amazing for rugby league because Russia is it's an amazing country. It's got a lot of potential. So if rugby league flourishes in Russia, you know, that would be amazing for the game. You know, with time, you know, I don't think today I would jump on a train without knowing where to go. You know, at the time, you know, I was very young and, you know, it was a different time. No mobile phones. No computers. You would just jump on a train and hoping somebody would be there. These days, you know, the world has changed.
Yeah.
But so you can just be nostalgic.
Well, I tell you, Ben, I think we're all glad you got on that train because you've been able to tonight, you know, tell us all about it. And what that journey entailed. So listen, thank you, Ben, for joining us from Moscow. It's been great to hear about your journey and your contribution, and great to hear that you're going to get yourself hopefully back involved. So thanks, Ben, for that.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Thanks to you, Graham. I think you haven't been mentioned enough. I'd like to take this opportunity to highlight the work you've done, because I remember working with you for the European Federation, and you know, I remember you speaking with a strong voice at every European meeting, and strong in a reassuring voice. Especially, I remember in 2007 when some nations were facing difficulties from rugby union, like Germany or Serbia. And I remember at the Wembley meeting, your strong but reassuring voice saying that you were in contact with the International Rugby Board and that you were dealing with this issue. So I think, I think you should be thanked as well for your effort for the game.
Thank you. That's very kind of you to say so, Ben. And thanks again for that journey, and long may it continue. Keep yourself on the train. That's the main thing to learn. Thanks, Ben. Listen, folks, that's wrapping up this 10th episode. Of course, we're seeing more and more rugby league coming out, and over COVID, obviously life's still a little bit difficult. So as we always say, please yourself, your families and your rugby league communities, stay healthy and as safe as you can. Thanks, everybody.